This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm your host, Elena McGrath. With me today is Ben Nobbs-Thiessen, an assistant professor of history at the University of Winnipeg. Ben is the author of Landscape of Migration, Mobility and Environmental Change on Bolivia's Tropical Frontier, 1952 to the present, out this year from the University of North Carolina Press. Landscape of Migration follows the entwined trajectories of Andean, Mennonite, and Okinawan migrants to lowland colonies outside of Santa Cruz, Bolivia, and in the process traces a history of agrarian citizenship and its contested relationship with both 20th century development processes and the landscapes they seek to transform. Welcome, Ben, to the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Oh, hi, Elena. Thanks for having me on the program. I'm doing well.
So let's start a little bit with some background about what happens in your books. For example, with the region of Santa Cruz, why did the lowlands of Bolivia become such a focal point for migratory and development projects over the course of the 20th century?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. I'm interested in kind of thinking about this in a spatial way. I just encourage anyone listening to go to Google Maps, look up Santa Cruz, and hit the satellite filter, right? So you can kind of get a sense of that landscape. And it's in a unique location, kind of smack dab in the middle of South America, which, depending upon the years of this book, might be perceived as the middle of nowhere or kind of the center of everything as the region changed. And you'll get a sense of Bolivia as quite a divided country, right, between a western sort of Andean highlands, a high plateau, as well as the valleys of the Andes, and then this vast expanse of lowlands, mostly densely forested, running kind of from the southern edges of Amazonia, which start basically just on the northern outskirts of Santa Cruz de la Sierra, the big city there, and then kind of transitioning down into a semi-tropical forest, and then eventually a much drier, almost scrub brush region of the Gran Chaco. And so Santa Cruz is kind of I think what environmental historians would refer to as an ecotone, right? It sits at the eastern edge of the last sort of mountains of the Andes and at the middle of these different lowland landscapes. As such, it was kind of uniquely positioned in a way as a potential node for development. And that's certainly what elites have been, proclaiming loudly to anyone who would listen for a long time, without much success at all. And they also kind of cried abandonment from the national government. This is a region that had no road connections, all weather road connections to the highlands where most people lived, nor any kind of rail connections to its frontiers with Argentina and Brazil. And these were something that elites in the region wanted. It's also kind of worth pointing out that, well, a large portion of Amazonia suffers from kind of soils that are initially fertile but quickly decline in fertility. There was sort of a deep soil, topsoil base in Santa Cruz, which made it quite a potentially productive region for intensive agriculture. So that was kind of the general context. And then, you know, thinking about the change in this location, just to give a broad sketch, this is a region, again, Santa Cruz Department, the territorial divisions in Bolivia are departments, and Santa Cruz, the largest in size of all Bolivian departments, but had a tiny population up to about 1950. There was a census in Bolivia. There's probably only maybe a little less than 50,000 people living in the city of Santa Cruz de la Sierra. And if we flash forward kind of half a century, the period covered by this book, today Santa Cruz is the largest city in Bolivia, larger at least individually than La Paz or El Alto together. They're about the same size. So it rapidly outpaced Andean urban centers over the course that is covered by this book, and really kind of grew into one of the most economically dynamic places in the country. And reportedly the fastest growing city in South America, the second fastest growing in all of the Americas, outside of Toluca, near Mexico City. And so it was a really rapid process of change, which I think makes it quite unique for Latin America in particular, where we just don't really see core sort of capitals, right, from the colonial period or the Republican period, I think Buenos Aires or Mexico City, being displaced by other regions. Certainly we see stories about regional growth, you know, in northern Mexico and southern Brazil. And maybe the Brazilian example of the earlier growth of Sao Paulo is somewhat comparable. But this is not common, right, to see that rapid displacement shift of resources to the other end of the country.
Especially after 1952, you have like the development of a really distinct regional identity, right, in the lowland area that contrasts itself from the highlands, and a kind of also seismic shift in where power could be derived in the country. So if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that would be great to touch on. You know, I like to think of myself as hopefully speaking to this group of scholars that are investigating the legacies of the 1952 revolution. And as I said, whereas, you know, for most of the late 19th, early 20th century, Santa Cruz elites and the small town were kind of petitioning the government for development funding, it didn't really happen. It didn't even really happen after Bolivia lost in the Chaco War with neighboring Paraguay, a conflict that took place in the region. And it wasn't really until the 1952 revolution when you had a unique combination, right, of Bolivia's revolutionary government putting together this plan, which, while kind of a core element to the revolution, is often sort of downplayed a bit in favor of very massive processes of social change, like the agrarian reform, the nationalization of the mines, and enfranchising the indigenous population, was this fourth dynamic, which was the March to the East, as it was often known. And that idea was kind of a rapid shift of resources towards the frontier. They used U.S. support in the 1950s and 60s. Bolivia received more absolute support than any other Latin American nation in the 50s, and more per capita in the 60s to build roads. They used cooperation with Brazil and Argentina to build rail networks. And so this development converged on the region, and the government also encouraged indigenous Bolivians, especially from the highlands, which they perceived in sort of the population logic of the day as overcrowded. We can debate what that might actually mean, to move down to the lowland frontier. Initially, small-scale colonies, eventually larger ones. And what we see is a huge process, a demographic shift in a nation which had long been based in the highlands, dependent upon mining, pushing its population down to the frontier with these very mid-20th century goals of food security, territorial integrity along this frontier zone. And as you point out, along the way, we see kind of profound intensification of a pre-existing regional dynamic that kind of separated highlanders, we'd also use the term Koyas, but from Cambas, this lowland population. And this, again, as I said, was sort of an identity that was in place previously, but it intensified with the arrival of these migrants. And so to briefly summarize, and others have discussed this as well, right, this was an argument that the lowland regions of Bolivia did not have neither the sort of larger Incan Empire legacy of the pre-colonial period, nor the colonial sort of legacy of the mining regions and Spanish control there, but were rather directly linked to lowland groups. So there was sort of a symbolic embrace of lowland groups like the Guarani, as opposed to, say, Aymara and Quechua groups that were arriving as settlers. And also a claim that the colonial heritage was that of the Rio de la Plata. And so it was the sort of Spanish conquistadors that had settled that region that were sort of the progenitors of identity in Santa Cruz. And that, of course, wasn't a surprising stance to take, given how rapidly the Rio de la Plata had grown in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Santa Cruz elites were watching that and kind of pinning their future onto that type of growth and really strategically distancing themselves from the highlands. So as I said, these identities quite latent for a period of time. With the 50s and especially the 60s, as thousands of migrants moved from the highlands to the lowlands, they intensified, they became more explicitly racialized, often pinned on these strategic embraces of a non-island indigenous identity.
Yeah, it's very interesting because if looking at Bolivian history, you have longstanding anxieties about, you know, territorial integrity, like the loss of vast tracts of land to neighboring countries in wars or in border disputes, and then also anxieties about having the wrong kind of population, right? So sort of eugenicist or anxieties about the whitening of or the lack thereof of the proper kind of migration to the country sort of come together in this space in Santa Cruz. And then in the mid-20th century, you argue that it takes on a kind of high modernist development project bent, and that the people who are, some of the people who are coming in to do some of this work are sort of, I guess what you might say is unexpected migrants, or at least in the annals of Latin American history, migratory communities that have not received a great deal of attention. So who are these new actors that you bring in?
Yeah, that's a great point to add into. And I just want to add in there as well. I really like your mention of sort of the anxieties and sometimes the racial pessimism that accompanied sort of a lot of the early 20th century political thought in Bolivia. Certainly in this case, if we just return for a second to the Andean migrants that are being brought down as colonists, there is this sort of sense that part of the MNR's larger goal of incorporating indigenous peoples into national life is really tied into transforming them into these settler migrants. And so they're going to transform the landscape. They're going to be transformed through the process of interacting with the landscape, and they'll become kind of full market producers for the nation, right? Although small farmers are hoping these people will be 50 hectare or sometimes 25 hectare farmers. So this is the major migration that takes place. But then it's paired with these other unexpected transnational streams. And if you were hanging out in La Paz in the immediate wake of the revolution, you might have bumped into some of these actors, which included a group of Low German speaking Mennonites. This is a Protestant or Anabaptist group that often lived in colonies, had established themselves in Latin America in the 1920s, and then kind of expanded through a series of sub-migrations to different regions. And these folks had a long sort of identity as farmers on frontier landscapes. Prior to Latin America, they had been living in the Russian Empire, farming the Ukraine well into the 1870s, when a group kind of facing some challenges to their ways of life, which included non-service in the military, running their own educational systems, decided to migrate to Canada and kind of became prairie settlers, frontier settlers in the recently created province of Manitoba, where I'm bound for my new job. By the 1920s, they kind of faced that similar dynamic in Canada. Language schools, Low German language schools in the colonies were being closed down, and some of the more traditional Mennonites opted to petition Latin American governments for the right to settle, again, kind of contested frontier environments, challenging often agricultural regions. And so they came to Mexico in the 20s, to Paraguay, just across from the region we're talking about in Bolivia in 1926, and really kind of got themselves mixed up in the middle of the Chaco War. And then by the 1950s, as this plan to develop Santa Cruz was gaining traction, a group of Mennonites from Paraguay arrived to sort of ask the government if they could have a similar set of guarantees freedom from military service, right? This was compulsory in Bolivia, as well as rights to run their own Low German schools and some other colony sort of institutions and live a relatively isolated life on the frontier. And they were welcomed in by the Bolivian government in 1954. We had a supreme decree that gave them rights that they were looking for under the specific condition that they participate in the agricultural developments of Bolivia. So that was front and center. So this was one group. At the same time, in those same years as the agrarian reforms being passed in Bolivia, we also had a small group of resident Japanese Bolivians, many who had arrived via Peru, kind of in the later stages of the rubber boom, and had settled in the Amazon and River Alta and these other areas, and learning of sort of the devastation of post-war Japan and Okinawa, and pressures with overcrowding and lack of resources, they petitioned the government to sort of bring in several thousand Okinawan settlers to lowland Bolivia. They'd already established a small sort of experimental colony not too far from Santa Cruz, and their idea was to expand this dramatically. And so this this case was a bit more, even more transnational perhaps than this Mennonite story winding through the Americas, in that at the time, the U.S. government was occupying, had claimed sovereignty over Okinawa, and was building military bases on about a third of the arable land on the islands. And so there was this real push factor from across the Pacific, that you had these displaced Okinawans who were perceived as potential radicals by U.S. forces. The U.S. government kept meticulous records on all Okinawan political organizing at this time. And it also contracted a sociologist out of the Hoover Institute, James Tigner, to travel around Latin America looking for, probably not put it another way, a place that they could dump this surplus population, or at least encourage them to emigrate to. I mean, certainly there was a desire in Okinawa to emigrate as well amid these challenging circumstances. And so Tigner bumps into this small organization of Japanese Bolivians, and they hatch a plan with the Bolivian government to also create an Okinawan colony in Santa Cruz. At the same time, and I'll just briefly mention, there's a separate Japanese colony, which is established there as well. And it might just be useful to kind of understand Okinawa as a colonized region incorporated as a prefecture of Japan in the 1870s, but with a distinct sort of cultural heritage. And so you get all these groups really settling alongside one another. If I went on a day trip from Santa Cruz, as I often did during my field work there, you could, in a very short period of time, pass through a colony, the first colony of sort of transplanted Andeans that had settled in the region, travel next to the first group of Paraguayan Mennonites that had settled there, that had formed a colony called Canadian One and Canadian Two, referencing their prior Canadian background. And then you could travel up to Okinawa One, Two, and Three along the major river. And so I just found that diversity of settlers quite fascinating, and kind of a unique way to look at comparative migratory dynamics.
So the transnational story you tell, because in this book you're both hyper local and regional and looking at national dynamics, and then also a kind of transnational, not just the Cold War, but a series of different movements across both the Atlantic and Pacific. It helps you get at something that that I guess complicates investigations into things like settler colonialism or comparing settler to other kinds of colonialism and in these contexts. And one of the things you bring up is symbolized concept of sub-imperialist migrations. And so these are not simple subjects in one context that then translate to the Bolivian context, right? All of these groups are navigating at multiple levels, countries that are host countries and to various degrees, either hostile to or anxious about them. So it's a really interesting dynamic that all gets brought together in this very, well, relatively small space.
Yeah, I think that is an excellent point to make about these different groups. And they have such different trajectories in a way that the kind of engaging in the comparison is challenging at times. But if you investigate some of their experiences, as you said, kind of within and between nations and empires, you really do see some commonalities. Mennonites perceive themselves certainly as the victims of sort of cultural assimilation policies, first in Russia, later in Canada, that drove them to Latin America. Okinawans had certainly had very similar experiences about sort of forced cultural change as they were progressively incorporated as a prefecture of Japan. Andeans, of course, also kind of faced a very paternalistic model of cultural change. Certainly the March to the East itself was based on that notion of transformation. And so these groups were also kind of non-citizens between nations, or partial citizens, or people that only recently gained full citizenship. And I find those overlaps, those actual points of overlaps, quite profound. The other kind of angle I hope to draw on certainly was to follow these migrants in the various places they went before arriving in Santa Cruz. And I mentioned the Okinawan story, which has been discussed in more depth, of course, in that historiography on U.S. occupation in Okinawa. I do delve quite heavily in chapter two into the Mennonite story as well, what conditions in northern Mexico, including a long mid-century drought, produced tensions in the Mennonite community there that would eventually lead them to Bolivia. And, you know, the Andeans, of course, as you said, this different trajectory of internal migration or internal colonialism had actually also had this pretty profound transnational experience, especially after the 52 revolution, which generated huge amounts of mobility among highland populations. An increasing number of Andeans would travel as seasonal workers from highland departments down into Argentina. And so many of them worked in these low-wage, highly exploited roles as sugarcane harvesters in Argentina, where, of course, they were then treated as foreigners, non-citizens, before migrating down to Santa Cruz. And indeed, the Bolivian government's policies of encouraging migration to Santa Cruz were often framed as sort of ending this loss of braceros, because they use the same term that we're familiar with in the U.S.-Mexico context, to Argentina. And so weaving those together is kind of one strategy I hope to adopt in several of these chapters, kind of moving between the local and the transnational.
Yeah, and it's such a great way of framing these stories. And so one of the things that you are really concerned with, I think particularly in chapter three, is how different communities and different groups are able to speak back to the state, you say, or to make claims on the state based on either their productivity, their relationship to the land, or their status as certain kinds of actors. And so in these stories, you have different kinds of migrants who in some cases are preferred by the state for various reasons, because the state is anxious and it wants the Andeans to stay within the country. But one of the great stories of the Bolivian 20th century is Andean indigenous communities becoming citizens and demanding the rights of citizenship. But as they move into the lowlands, they are also settlers displacing other less visible indigenous communities. But they're also moving into a context of lowland communities where there's already a long history of migration. And so in some cases, they might be preferred, but in many cases, the Mennonite communities are read as, for example, German and therefore white, and therefore implied more modern in certain ways, even as they're pursuing a different kind of approach to community building and in fact, trying to protect themselves in some ways from the state. So I would love to hear more about these kind of preferred migrants, or at least the ways that these communities do communicate and speak to the state.
Great. Yeah, I think to draw back on that idea that all of these groups are, you know, questionable citizens, or their belonging is certainly questioned by different actors, right? Whether it's the state or local elites or other populations that are sometimes being displaced by their arrival. They're really forced to kind of legitimate their claims to belong in that region through their transformation of the landscape and through their role as farmers, as productive farmers, fitting in with the sort of model of food security in Bolivia, right? Producing these crops that Bolivia previously had to import. So they all do make a common claim to an extent to this idea of agrarian citizenship. But how they do it and their ability to sort of do it is also dependent upon many other factors related to sort of ideas about race and modernization. And so I could touch a little bit on how some of these groups respond. Jumping back to the Okinawans is kind of an interesting starting point. They do have advocates in the country, this very small community that had existed beforehand of Japanese Bolivians. They do have a powerful international ally, right, in the United States, which is also supporting a lot of these development projects in Bolivia and has an agreement with the Bolivian government. And so that is one way in which they're sort of successful in inserting themselves into this environment, but they end up facing a much stronger racialized hostility. And there's nothing subtle about the racial hostility towards Japanese settlers in Bolivian newspapers, especially in Santa Cruz, the newspaper El Deber in the 1950s, that discusses them as an invasion, that sometimes makes the rhetorical sort of arguments a bit insincere in certain ways. If you think what happens next, that braceros should be brought back from Argentina, these Bolivian braceros, before this foreign element is brought in. And it was compelling to kind of investigate the way that Okinawans and Japanese migrants as well negotiated that xenophobia and that hostility, often through sort of these model performances of agrarian citizenship. When they encountered hostile editorials in the newspaper, they'd invite the entire editorial board out to visit the colonies. After you see these sort of reluctant retractions of the editorials in the paper, admitting that the Okinawan colonists are developing the land, and they're not, some accusations are that they're fishermen and they're not even farmers, right? And so they're able to kind of overturn these local hostilities. And sometimes those hostilities run up through higher levels of government. But I think largely successful despite a profound initial hostility. And that does speak to the changing view of Japanese and Okinawan migrants in Latin America. And Brazilian historians would probably be more familiar with that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. With the rise of Japan in the post-war period, its economic success, that characteristic being Japanese is often tied to ideas about economic progress that temper sort of an earlier racial hostility. So that's one kind of factor. I think Mennonites arriving in the region, as you say, are kind of, they're coded as white. This is a region that has sort of a history of small-scale German merchant migration. So there's an established community that sees these migrants as racially desirable. But it's tempered a little bit by the sort of expressed traditionalism of this community, right? Their explicit desire enshrined in law not to participate in surrounding society, to live sort of at the margins of society on farmland that might be occupied by other communities. They do sort of meet some hostility in that regard, but they're largely, again, able to kind of use these performances of good agrarian citizenship, whether it's making symbolic donations of colony goods to leaders, or even behind the scenes negotiations. They're quite effective at working with legal counsel to secure or maintain their privileges. They end up negotiating that. And everywhere they kind of brandish this resume as proven agricultural pioneers as they'd see themselves on frontier landscapes, right? It's almost like a genealogy of, Ukraine, Canadian prairies, northern Mexico. And it's quite ultimately successful in that regard. The final kind of question, which is really what I delve into mostly in chapter three and chapter four, is this idea of how transplanted Andeans engage in this claim on the state. There's a great sort of set of sources, which are incomplete in some ways, but these are letters that have been collected by the Office of the President and the Institute of Colonization, which are housed in the National Archives in Sucre. And they give this really sort of intimate portrait of the types of claims that Indigenous petitioners are making when they want to go to the lowlands, so when they're still residing in their highland communities, and also once they've arrived in the lowland regions, we get kind of a portrait, shocking at times, of some of the conditions in those areas. And so to run through what some of those strategies are for making claims on their rights to land, they certainly directly invoke, almost word for word at times, aspects of the revolutionary policy of the March to the East, of diversifying food production, food security, territorial integrity, when they want to make those claims. They also evoke a sort of very challenging environmental imaginary of the Andes. And through this book, you'll see that Andes and the Amazon and the Andes and the broader lowland region played off against one another. And Indigenous petitioners often refer to the lands that they hold, especially in Potosí or Oruro, as sort of, deserts without support for the life of man. They just speak about being affected by prolonged droughts, of crop failures, of animal failures. And so they invoke that environmental imaginary, even as they kind of conjure up the lowlands as this place, this sort of fertile, lush landscape awaiting transformation. And that fits quite closely with the state's own imagination of those two landscapes. They certainly invoke the Argentina connection. They often claim that if assistance and land is not given, they'll have to migrate out to the neighboring nation of Argentina. So they try and shame the state into action. And sometimes, and you work on mining communities, so you'll know that they also make much more radical claims, almost threatening claims on the state and its commitment to its revolutionary legacy. So they do all of that in the highlands. And then we get this very different portrait in the lowlands. Certainly pamphlets and films produced for distribution in Bolivia made large claims about the way the state would support migrants when they arrived on the lowland frontier. Medical centers, agricultural extension, seed, credit, you know, almost immediate, you know, within 3 years, access to secure title, and lowland migrants to Santa Cruz and other regions of the lowlands find next to none of these things provided. Extreme scarcity, disconnection from original local markets, exploitative pricing when they are finally able to market their products. And so I explore kind of in the later part of that chapter, the way that they push back on the state in the absence of these state claims that everything will be provided for migrants. And it starts out as a sort of, again, sort of epistolary tradition of letter writing, but it transforms into much more radical tactics, especially in the late 60s, when settlers begin to blockade roads, occupy major cities in the lowlands, eventually sometimes take international development workers, the people who are sort of the financiers of these projects, hostage and hold them hostage to guarantee that, for instance, a bridge across a river that was promised will actually be constructed. And this does some things. It's successful in certain ways. It also increases that sort of hostility on the part of lowland elites to these indigenous migrants. And it changes profoundly in the wake of Bolivia's transition to authoritarianism.
It's interesting. You are tracing a kind of prehistory of some of the protest and mobilization tactics that contemporary observers in Bolivia would be extraordinarily familiar with, both in the highlands and in the lowlands. But so I want to pinpoint this turning point that you are just alluding to in the 1970s. And you write about how both the Revolutionary Nationalist Movement, the party that was in power from 52 to 64, as well as the military governments that succeeded that party, they were both at least deeply rhetorically committed to developing Bolivia through colonization in part and diversifying the economy. But as you argue, often this commitment wasn't backed up with actual infrastructure assistance, or at least infrastructural assistance didn't arrive in the ways that it was often intended to. But really in the 70s, with the emergence of the much more violent Banzer dictatorship, you have a rollback of state commitments. While Banzer is still interested in development projects, there's a kind of shift in relationship, right, between what the state looks like and what the colonists are demanding. And you talk about a kind of opening up of space in this period for non-governmental and especially faith-based organizations to come in and do the development work that the state either could not or would not do.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Elena. It is an interesting moment of transition, and to an extent, there is continuity here. As you said, the authoritarian state under Banzer remains very committed to developing the lowlands, and notoriously, of course, providing extensive lands to kind of political cronies. But also, it does continue with some of the largest colonization projects in Bolivian history, including the San Julian project, which I look at in this chapter. But I do note that change that you mentioned, that there is kind of a more pronounced shift to non-state actors that act as kind of proxies for the state in this case. And I think if we look at the broader history of Bolivia and other regions of Latin America at this time, we'll see the huge explosion of kind of NGO activity, some with direct faith-based connections, others less so, that kind of steps in for a state that's no longer willing to even rhetorically kind of provide, you know, that assistance. And so to zoom in on a little bit of what happens in this chapter, it is a bit of a fascinating case. And it centers on the work of something called the United Church Committee, which involves an unlikely kind of alliterative coalition of these Methodist missionaries that have been working in Bolivia for some time, a group of Mennonites, but not colony Mennonites, but rather North American Mennonites working for a Mennonite relief agency, and then a group of Maronal nuns. And these three sort of groups, Catholic and then two Protestant, come together in the wake of a devastating flood, which impacts a lot of the major colonization zones in the lowlands. The flood is almost contiguous with the map of colonization over the previous decades. And people are displaced from throughout the region, and they converge on the small city of Montero, now a pretty big city, just north of Santa Cruz. It's in the center of all these colonization projects. So the Okinawans are flooded out. Indigenous migrants of the Yapakani are flooded out. Some of the Mennonite colonies, to an extent that are there, are flooded out. And as refugees stream into the city, local elites, again, not very comfortable with having these indigenous settlers in the city for a long period of time. So they turn to these religious organizations, which all have kind of their bases in Montero, to help coordinate sort of a refugee camp for the displaced flood victims. And they spend several weeks in this camp, and the members of the camp organize firewood brigades, cooking brigades, all sorts of other things, really kind of providing most of their own services with some guidance from these missionaries and other figures. And what kind of happens in the wake of that is pretty fascinating in that the flood example, the refugee camp, becomes a model for new forms of colonization. And while some people return to their homes after the flood, a significant group, a few hundred, are unable to because the river has shifted course. And they join with this group of religious non-state actors to develop new colonies to the north of Santa Cruz, first an experimental colony for the flood victims, and then a couple of years later, a new colony for arriving settlers from the highlands. And finally, in 72, they begin this colony known as the San Julian colony, which is to the east of the Rio Grande, the major river there, and becomes, by many accounts, sort of one of the more successful colonies in Bolivian history. If you readers of the book would look at the front of the book, they'll see that unique pinwheel style formation represents about 70 nuclei, which extend off of one of the main roads. And unlike earlier forms of colonization, which placed settlers on these never-ending sort of piano key style roads, right, where people's plots were just strung out on these penetration roads, the idea of this project was quite different, that you have these pinwheel-shaped formations, you have central services in the middle, wells, schools, some form of store, and that this creates a sort of sense of settler solidarity. In addition to that, settlers were kind of given this six-week crash course in colony formation, in organizing of their own sort of production brigades, in partnership with this religious NGO, which kind of created, you know, the model in collaboration with that initial group of flood victims and then carried it to these new sites. And so year after year, these colonies expanded as part of the San Julian Project all through the 1970s and really attracted the attention of a huge swath of the international development community, partly because they had remarkably low abandonment rates. So a lot of the abandonment that had taken place in the 1960s when settlers found themselves, you know, without any state support at all, was actually reduced in this period of time in which there wasn't that much more state support. But the structure, the sort of solidarity mechanisms put in place in the colony, in almost a cynical way, tended to encourage colonists to not expect that support and really kind of develop their own cooperative organizations in the absence of the state, but kind of in partnership with this group of religious actors. And so a bit of a fascinating story for me. And the chapter does go back in time really to the post-revolutionary period, because it is after 52 when we see Protestant organizations expand their activities in Bolivia under the new government. And they're invited by Paz Estenssoro into the lowlands to do that work. And so they've been working there all through the 50s and 60s, when those first colonies are sort of taking place in Santa Cruz. They've seen some of the roadblocks, the hostage taking, the occupations I talked about previously. And indeed, Methodists have participated in some of those activities. What's kind of remarkable is that the Banzer coup happens. Some of those members of the Methodist Church are arrested. But both the Methodist Church and this Mennonite organization are able to continue their work under Banzer. In fact, they're invited in to take on this new project. And so they provide kind of like a through road for me, showing the kind of role of faith-based activity in these presumably secular development projects. And for many, there's sort of this tension between the supposed evangelical work that certain organizations should be doing and their work in what amounts to kind of conventional development, modernization, or rural development.
And so in this story, one of the things you are tracing is it's not just one group, for example, of Mennonite actors or any particular religious group. It's a series of people collaborating in interesting ways to pursue these projects. But I want to transition now to the fifth chapter of your book, which is about the growth of the industrial soybean economy in Bolivia, and is something that people who write about Bolivia often are not focusing on too much, and in which Mennonite settlers play a very big role. But I want to start actually by asking you to talk about the way you begin your fifth chapter, where you are reflecting on two sort of simultaneous groups of, I guess I would say, hapless would-be explorers or settlers around Camiri. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. You know, you got to start with a hook sometimes, right? And it just turns out that in the late 1960s, in 1967, there are these two groups that are sort of exploring, scouting the region to the south of Santa Cruz, observing the landscape. And that is the first, what will become the first major migration of Mennonites. There's a small group from Paraguay before, but the first major group from Mexico, scouting the land, purchasing what will become the largest Mennonite colonies in Bolivia, and which have produced several sort of, we call them almost daughter or child colonies since then. So they're out there with the members of the National Institute of Colonization, looking at a property they want to purchase. And not too far away, up in the hills on the eastern flank of the Andes, is, of course, a sort of Cuban guerrilla activity spearheaded by Che Guevara, including cooperation from some Bolivians that are thinking about this as a place to launch the next major revolution. And I kind of begin with that contrast because, of course, aside from a convenient hook, I argue that both those groups kind of viewed the frontier, viewed that sort of that space as a great opportunity for autonomous action. It was an area sort of at the margins of the state and one that they thought they could strategically use. They both had success in those sort of frontier landscapes before and that they thought they could kind of transition to in Bolivia. And the contrast is notable, of course, because the following year, Che Guevara's small party is wiped out by a group of U.S.-trained Bolivian rangers, whereas, as I point out in the chapter, the Mennonite presence expands dramatically across Bolivia over the following decades, reaching a present-day population of around 100,000, maybe in close to 100, probably about 80-plus different farming colonies. So a huge landscape transformation coming from that one group of foreigners. The other, of course, having a very long revolutionary legacy, but a very limited physical transformation of the Bolivian environment.
I guess one of the things that jumped out at me about the way you're thinking about the soybean economy and the sort of transformations of the environment that happen is the development of a kind of form of agriculture that, in the case of one of the actors you talk to, they claim is more like mining than cultivating, right? Is something that involves extraction of great profit, a different kind of labor relationship. And so this is something that, bringing back to your framing, potentially creates a really different kind of subject relationship and a really different kind of, for example, citizen. If you are the implicit idea of an agrarian citizen is some kind of caretaker relationship to the land or deeply enmeshed in the land. But if industrial agriculture is something that is more like extractivism, that does really change the terms in which you think about it.
I put that very nicely, Elena. Certainly, yes, I think this transition to soybeans results in a huge transformation of the rhetoric of agrarian citizenship and the ability for individuals to claim this. So in a way, there's kind of, again, a through line. We do see under soybeans just a continuation of this push for development, agricultural developments on the lowland frontier. If you want to look at it in a different way, it is a fundamental transformation in the meaning of that development. Certainly the MNR's plans coming out of the revolution, right, are for primarily framed around this notion of food security, producing those things that Bolivia had previously had to import to food, to feed the cities and the mines, right? Things like beef and sugar and rice, cotton for a while kind of has a role in that as well. The March to the East is somewhat successful at filling those gaps quite quickly. By the 60s, the market at Santa Cruz is flooded with rice from some of these colonies. With sugarcane, there's actually a very quick limit on the amount that is accepted by the local mills. And so we do see in the 70s already sort of a tentative shift and a search for new types of crops that can be used to generate export income rather than those that are used to feed the nation, right? And that's kind of a really sort of symbolically laden way to frame what you're doing, whether it is generating income through export or feeding, you know, feeding Bolivians. And so the shift to soy is fundamental there. Again, Bolivia experiments with cotton when cotton prices are high in the 70s, that they crash and land that's just cleared rapidly is sort of left turned over often to shifting, eroded sort of dunes. But by the late 70s and early 80s, there's this new push for soybeans. And this is a broader regional story. Of course, it really begins more profoundly in neighboring Brazil already in the 1960s and 70s. But up to the present involves, as you said, what's referred to as often as Soylandia or the United Republic of Soy, a huge section of soybean production, which produces now the majority of the world's soy. In the 2000s, Brazil outpaced the U.S. as major soy producers and became this mainstay for economies in recently cleared areas, forest areas of inland South America. So Bolivia belatedly jumped onto this production strategy, but it fundamentally shifted the meaning of the march to the east. And certainly critiques of that transition that I heard from people I interviewed were that farming had become like mining. I think Bolivianists would often refer to sort of neo-extractivism, right, as the model for this, in which gas production in Santa Cruz is not that different than soybean production. One of the reasons for this, of course, is also the different sort of labor demands of that industry, the requirements for mechanization, that displace a lot of these more heavily manual labor, these crops that are produced more often through forms of manual labor. So there is a depletion of the labor needs as well. One of the Mennonites I interviewed who got into soy in the 1980s described the process as almost as though it was done without work. And this was an individual who had previously been sort of like hand planting corn on newly cleared land. And so it was something that this individual embraced. Others kind of see this as the antithesis of agrarianism in this context. The specific case is interesting to look at as well, and that's what I wanted to give to this emerging field of studies of the soy boom, which, as Latin Americanists, we can see analogies to earlier sort of commodity-based histories, right, of Latin America's export boom, but we don't see as many historical studies of it. We see social scientists discussing soy, contemporary analysis by journalists, political scientists, but not much historical attention to that earlier period of time. And I think when we do see it, we often see this sort of macro level analysis of some of the major corporations which dominate global soy production and marketing. And what I hope to do in this chapter is really kind of give this ethnic window, I suppose, on how a specific community related to the soy boom. And a bunch of factors come together in Bolivia. I could just discuss quickly to situate Mennonites as sort of the pioneers of soy production in that region. We have seed technology coming in to research stations produced in collaboration between Brazil and the U.S. So it jumps the border from Brazil into Bolivia. We have the search for these export-generating crops, these new types of crops. In Santa Cruz, there's an entrepreneur, a Croatian migrant, the Marinković family that had come in after World War II. And operated one of Santa Cruz's largest oil processing plants. And he'd been working with oil seed, with cotton previously, but begins to encourage producers in the region to start growing soybeans that he can crush at his plant for oil. And forges a relationship with Mennonites that have arrived from Mexico to start producing soybeans, helps them kind of develop production strategies at the same time as entrepreneurs within that Mennonite colony who a surprising sort of degree of transnationalism are also traveling up to the U.S. and purchasing equipment to import back to Bolivia, usually secondhand, sort of almost obsolete equipment in the U.S. But this is the machinery that drives forward Mennonite soy production. Bolivia at the same time is starting to open up its economy, right, in the transition, the very difficult years of the early 1980s, mid-1980s with hyperinflation to exports into the region. And they do so at this kind of unique time in which one of the major sources of animal feed, fish meal stocks produced largely through the Peruvian and Chaveta trade have collapsed due to overfishing and El Nino. And soy meal is really kind of replacing fish meal as the primary, fodder in this sort of industrialized meat production. And so these different factors come together, and as they are more mechanized than most surrounding communities, Mennonites by the late 70s, despite the fact that they only use steel wheels on their tractors, part of the argument that forced them to leave Mexico, have about 10 times as many tractors among 12,000 Mennonites as the entire rural population of Santa Cruz, about 300,000 people, are really well positioned to embrace the soy boom. And in my interviews with Mennonites in these colonies, you really see this sort of almost euphoric move into soy production. It results in great increase in land cleared in the colonies. And then by the late 80s, severe sort of issues with drought, with wind-based erosion, and a lot of people lose everything in that initial soy boom. People continue to farm soy today, but they really do have a challenging experience with that, which leads them kind of back to this dairy-based production, which they've pioneered in Mexico and also brought to Bolivia. And so again, in the kind of unique way for these Mennonite farmers is that they do engage in this cash cropping for the market at the same time as they do have this almost artisanal small-scale dairy cheese production that sort of helps sustain them when that cash cropping fails for market reasons or for environmental reasons. And so I examine that interplay through the 80s and through the 90s, a period of economic crises for much of it for Bolivia, but a period in which soy production is expanding dramatically. So that's kind of how I want to sort of approach that broader history of the soy boom, which I hope to see the literature really expand on that in the coming years from a specific sort of grounded perspective.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you brought up the kind of the really transnational dynamics of thinking about the history of this boom, but also what it meant in Bolivia. And one of the things your book repeatedly does is create a transnational context for a place that really has often been kind of provincialized from studies of global history. And so in your book is just throughout your book, you bring in context of, you know, this comparative Cold War context, thinking about how different high modernist projects are happening in parts of Africa or Asia or other parts of Latin America, and really constantly making those connections where what's going on in Bolivia is really important to what's going on globally. And as a fellow Bolivianist, I just want to say that's great. It's something that I really appreciate, and it's sometimes hard to do in this context. And so I'm going to sort of transition that to just a question about how you managed to organize this project, because your book, you're looking at least three migrations, at least three different national or local or different kinds of migratory contexts. You're looking at sources that include documentaries, colonization records. You do a huge number of oral histories. So how did you approach doing this extraordinarily ambitious project, and how did you write such a readable book coming out of all of this together?
Well, I'm flattered by those comments. Thanks, Lena. I'm glad that especially the transnational element resonates, because I do think that is an aspect of just, I think partly a luxury of just what a fascinating place Bolivia is for scholars of the region, that sometimes internal dynamics kind of take precedent over transnational connections, because it still is a country with these profound transnational ties. And so I think of the chapter structure, I was always kind of interested in making that dance between a very local description of something going on in Santa Cruz, how this was read through sort of a national lens, and then looking for that transnational tie, whatever it might be. And as you say, a lot of these things are happening either just with contemporary parallel context or sometimes direct connections to other parts of the world. You know, the Methodist Church, which became so active in Chapter 4 and development, declared Bolivia a land of decision in the 1950s and promoted it among Methodist would-be missionaries. But it also declared the Belgian Congo a land of decision, Korea, as well as parts of Indonesia. And so it was involved in these multiple locales. And I find that fascinating. Sometimes there's space to really dive into that. Sometimes it gets a mention in the book. But as far as structuring what I did, I think there's a few things going on. One thing I think I was influenced pretty early on by reading another book about South American interior, Hugh Raffles in Amazonia, which engages in this really kind of mixed bag chapter to chapter analysis of all sorts of different types of sources and types of actors that are working on the same landscape that have completely different sort of sets of knowledges or technologies they're applying there. And I really kind of saw that as a model for looking at a frontier landscape like Santa Cruz as well. And the other part is a bit more strategic, and this is just the challenge of working on some of these regions. The lack sometimes of a full source base really forces you to look for different types of sources. And so when I stumbled across a series of films and short documentaries and pamphlets that represented lowland colonization more as kind of an imaginary of the state, I really kind of seized on that for chapter one and thought about representation. And I stumbled across a trove of documents about Okinawa under U.S. occupation at the U.S. National Archives that helped shape a significant portion of chapter two. And similar ways with these religious NGO actors, there's quite extensive archival resources available in the United States, where a lot of these organizations have their headquarters. So I did work in the Methodist Archives held at Drew University, and then Mennonite Central Committee, this Mennonite NGO up in Akron, Pennsylvania. And the kind of fascinating thing there is that they maintain not simply records of their activities in Bolivia, but really kind of extensive archival records for periods in which we don't have a centralized archive in Bolivia. And I've talked to other researchers that have had similar success with the Maranal Archive or other sort of NGO and religious archives. Because a lot of the materials were not centralized, especially for the recent period, because this book runs all the way through the 20th century. It became progressively more difficult to find archival sources as we entered into the period of dictatorship in the 1970s. And last of all, for the Mennonites in Chapter 5, right, this is a group who have intentionally often escaped the archive, and especially among the group of old colony Mennonites of Bolivia, have not engaged in the sort of writing of their own history that other Mennonites have undertaken at times, and that other groups I study, like the Okinawans, regularly do. They make repeated sort of colony-wide collections of history books that they produce and records. And so oral history was kind of just the necessary path forward for that group.
Okay, so I think I have taken up a great deal of your time, and I have one final question that is kind of an unfair one to ever ask a historian, which is, in the past year, there's been some substantial changes in the Bolivian situation and a kind of uprising of the lowlands in certain ways, or something that could be read as that. So do you think your book, what do you think your book offers contemporary observers of what's going on in Bolivia right now?
Yeah, it's challenging in a way, especially being so close to it. Time-wise, there's certainly others, the colleagues we know, political scientists, the journalists that have written extensively on this already. I do hope that given the role of Santa Cruz in all this, when you have the president of the committee pro Santa Cruz, demanding that Evo resign, sort of a central actor in his eventual ouster. This is an organization that was active in the 1950s, petitioning against Highland migrants, organizing against the central government in conflicts over oil royalties, which I discuss in the first chapter of this book. And so you can kind of see those echoes of this sort of regional state conflict at play. I think the other important question to think about, and I do use a little bit of Evo's personal trajectory to kind of frame this book, is that the terminology I should add is one that's been discussed in Bolivia. People, references to Bolivians as sort of settlers or colonists in their own land is something that's contested. There's terms sort of interculturals that are often used in place of that. But the president himself has this trajectory as a settler, someone whose family traveled to Argentina as field laborers in the 1960s, who eventually settled in a colony in the Chapare, created initially by the MNR in the 1960s, although it was quite small at the time. And then, of course, made good and came back to the center of power. And so his own trajectory, as well as the opposition that he faced, both kind of created or enabled by that longer process of the march to the east. And if we think a little bit about the period of time that preceded this dramatic political transition, right, which are the fires, the extensive fires that were covered quite widely in the international media in the summertime, these were taking place in an area where we saw unprecedented development in the last couple of decades, and especially under Evo's government, which had adopted a strong environmentalist policy, but of course also did push forward a policy of extraction in the lowlands. I remember attending a day of corn outside of Santa Cruz, one of these agricultural fairs, and listening to his vice presidents talk about tripling the frontier, expansion in the next few years. And that certainly came to pass. Especially, I encourage anyone to look at Landsat sort of photos of the area east of the Rio Grande in Santa Cruz and to see how much land transformation you have over the past few years under Evo's government. So I think that's an important part of the story as well. Both the long trajectories of the regional resistance, the president's own trajectory, and the continuing role of frontier development in Bolivia today. Indeed, amid the fires, a new export contract to export Bolivian beef directly to China had just been signed as well, providing another sort of cash cropping opportunity for a good that had once been considered an item of food security. These are trajectories that are still definitely playing out.
Very much changing and very much building on the history that you trace here. Well, thank you so much, Ben. And I really appreciate you spending some time talking about your book. And I really encourage readers to go out and check it out. There's a lot in there. So thank you.
Thanks a lot, Lana. I deeply appreciate you taking the time to speak with me.